John, what kind of patent did you have? A utility patent or a design patent? And can you explain if you know the difference?
A utility patent is what I have, and it's basically a function. The abductor, as I mentioned earlier, allows you to function by moving the spinal column or the torso or your whole waistline or abdominal region in a specific function. So that's the utility of that. A design patent is like the best example, and if you go on the internet and you look up design patents, usually an icon of the Coca-Cola bottle comes up, that symmetrical Coca-Cola bottle. That bottle's design, that symmetrical design, is a design patent, has basically no function to it, and some people may argue, well, the gripping of it where it narrows out, you could get your hands in there and it won't slip out of your hands, things like that. I mean, these are all part of the descriptive process in putting together intellectual property, and something as simple as a bottle design could have 30 pages of descriptions to it, and I encourage all the inventors out there or people interested in this to go to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and click on either trademarks and particularly patents and start reading some of these descriptions, and you'll be blown away at how deep and detailed these descriptions get. That's why I mentioned earlier, you don't get a patent right away because you need to learn to describe not only the product you're going to bring into the marketplace, you need to be able to describe, if somebody wants to knock it off, what would they do to get around your patent that would allow them to have something that is non-infringing to your product but was inspired by your product. For instance, you know, if you look at the old glasses, for instance, that you drink out of, you just put your hand around the glass, right? And somebody says, well, hey, you know, if I put hot liquid in that glass, if I grab the glass, I'm going to burn my hands, let me put a handle on there. So the guy who invented the mug and put the handle on the glass doesn't infringe on the guy who invented the glass, so to say. I'm just giving an example here, because the handle makes it different enough that was inspired from the original invention, but in and of itself, it's a totally different function. However, if the guy who invented the glass only marketed the glass, but in his patent description, he says, well, we could put handles to it, we could put different bases to it, you know, this, that, and the other. Whatever he put in his patent description, even though it may not be seen in the marketplace, he still has it protected in his patent description. So you go beyond the scope of what's originally being patented, and that's where, like with the abductor, I had engineers look at my product and say, hey, what would you do different? Or look at my product, and if you wanted to knock me off, what would you do to knock me off? And it's like, okay, put that in the patent description. And it's so helpful because, you know, I've read patent descriptions, like I mentioned before, that are 20, 30 plus pages long for what we would think to be one little simple idea. These ideas aren't simple, Michael. They're very complex, especially when you need to protect it. It's almost like you have a baby and you're trying to envision that baby when that baby is a full adult, you know. Here's this baby breastfeeding, and it looks one way, and then when it gets older, and it's got different color eyes, different color hair, it's a different body shape, all this other stuff, what will that baby or that brainchild of yours, that invention, what kind of forms will it take on as it matures, and how can we dress it up later on? And all that is considered and or should be implemented into your patent.
So advice to the listeners, don't skimp on a patent attorney.
Don't skip on a patent attorney. You know, I consult with inventors all the time. I consulted with three of them yesterday alone. All of them say, I don't have the money. I don't have the money. And I say, well, you need to find the funds to get a good patent attorney to do a search and to put together a good description for you. And the description is also in the provisional patent application. Your provisional patent application may be the same application of the patent if you don't change the product, but it's a lot cheaper. I think it's $1,500 compared to over $5,000. And each patent attorney is different, and the fees at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office keep escalating. But to have the security of a legal licensed counselor is imperative for your future. A lot of people are out of the gates with no money. Now, here's what happens to a lot of inventors. A lot of inventors come to me and say, hey, John, I got this idea, but I got no money. Would you be interested in marketing my idea? Now, when somebody comes to you with just an idea and it's scribbled out on paper, they got nothing protected, they haven't put one penny into it, it is the highest risk for me or a marketing company or an investor to get involved. So that inventor is going to get paid very, very small because we have to incur not only the cost, but it's going to take us over a year to develop this project. Projects don't come on the air, at least on TV, within 2 or 3 months. I mean, it takes a long time, especially if it's a tangible product and we're shipping goods in from out of the country. But the more an inventor can do, like if an inventor comes to me and says, hey, I got a patent, it's already secured. And all of a sudden I'm thinking, hey, I got anywhere from $15,000 to $25,000, maybe $50,000 in legal fees that I don't have to pay. This guy already paid. okay, he deserves a little more. Or if he says, hey, guess what? I got manufacturing secured. I got my prototypes already done. Just bring them to the factory and they'll replicate those. Hey, I don't have to pay my engineers and do prototyping, which is a huge cost because you have to pay your engineers and or take your engineers off of current projects to work on this new project. The more an inventor can bring to the companies that he or she wants to manufacture, market, or distribute and or advertise, the more leverage the inventor has in getting paid. So a lot of inventors say, oh, I got ripped off. They really didn't get ripped off when they understand the complexity and the risk and the cost and the energies involved in taking your idea to fruition and having it being sold in the marketplace.
What about the commercials I see with the caveman and some of these services? Is that something that you'd recommend people give a try to?
I'm going to say no. And the reason why I say no is because I know a lot of people who've been ripped off by these people. And the other reason why I say no is I'm kind of partial because I formed an organization called NICA, which is the National Inventors Coaching Alliance. And what NICA is, it's real people like myself who you see on TV all the time that it's like, hey, this is a real person who was just like me, an inventor many years ago, who made it, and I'm making millions of dollars right now with my technologies. I'm a real person doing real business, generating real results. Now, when you watch those caveman ads on TV, who are these people? I don't know who that person is. When you go to their websites, you look at their products. I've never seen these products in the marketplace. They may be good people. They may be legitimate people. But I would feel far more comfortable in dealing with somebody who I have a familiarity with because we all have better business bureau track records. We're under investigation constantly with the FTC, so we're FTC privy. We stay aligned with the FTC. In fact, everything that we do, we consult with FTC attorneys saying, hey, here's a project we want to get ourselves involved in. What are the guidelines for us to do this? Because a lot of companies who don't get themselves involved with an alliance like mine, the National Inventors Coaching Alliance, embark on producing an infomercial or any type of marketing campaign, they put it on TV and all of a sudden they're hit with lawsuits and fines that they can't substantiate their claims, this, that, and the other, because what they are doing in their show, even if they're doing it honestly, is not abiding to FTC principles. So that's one of the guidelines. But I've heard so many inventors, and I haven't really heard one success story that has gone to those invention submission companies and have succeeded. What they want is huge upfront fees, which they entice you into paying, and they get it. That's how these companies stay in business. And again, I can't speak for everybody, Michael. I'm sure there's some good companies out there, but NICA, the organization I formed, we are not an invention submission company, although we have companies that are always looking for inventions. You know, the company that says, come on in, let's see your idea, and hey, pay me $12,000 and I'll help you with this thing. I raise red flags when people try to go that route. And the commonality I see with a lot of inventors, and I speak one-on-one in groups, I do keynote speaking. As you know, I'll be at the INPEX convention in June. This is going to be airing before June. The Response Magazine Expo convention, I have a great relationship with Response Magazine, is that every inventor, there's not one that I haven't spoken to that hasn't been ripped off or doesn't know who to trust. There's some negative emotion, which is a legitimate negative emotion. So my alliance with the National Inventors Coaching Alliance is there to act as a buffer and a security blanket to inventors so we can connect you to the right professionals.
Were you ripped off in your patent process at all? And tell me, you filed your first patent. Was it only a U.S. patent? And when did you expand to international patents or additional patents?
Well, I originally filed in two countries. And basically, when you file for a patent, at least what I was counseled at the time, is that you file in the place of origin or where it's being manufactured, which mine was in China, and then your major distribution, which was here in the U.S. The Abdur took off. I mean, we sold 1 million units in 5.5 months. It was the biggest, fastest, most revenue-generating product sales fitness product of all time.
Once it took off, did you have to file another patent to protect?
Once the product took off, and it took off very fast and very big, I mean, some big, big numbers, other countries were interested. So now all of a sudden we had to file in other countries. Now, the fortunate thing, I had licensed it to a marketing company who had now seen the potential. And although I and or my partnership or my company, who I had an angel investor who was a great guy, and he was more than an angel, just giving me money, he was involved in the daily operations. He was a very astute businessman. We had funded the Chinese and U.S. patents. the marketing company says, hey, this thing is flying. We have other countries that want this product. They incurred all the expenses, and our deal didn't change. I got the same royalties and everything like that, which is a beautiful thing. So if you could prove your product, especially in that type of scenario where sales are thriving, it lowers their risk, and they'll definitely stick their hands deeper in their pockets to invest more into it.
Ballpark, what did it cost for those first patents?
Patents for China and the United States, I'm thinking it was about $25,000 to $30,000 with everything. We have patents, we have trademarks. I produced instructional videotapes, which I wanted to copyright and trademark all those. There were several patents on the Abdur. As I mentioned before, there's a lot more versions of the Abdur than what meets the eye and what people have seen on TV. I got lower price versions, I got higher price versions, I got medical versions, I got rehabilitation, sports training versions. So there's a lot of different versions, and as a result of that was obviously the patent attorney says, okay, if I'm going to draw this description, I'm going to spend X amount of hours more describing this, so you obviously pay more. So we were willing to fund as much as we needed to fund to protect what we felt was a viable idea. And albeit, Michael, this was before we sold unit number one. We just believed in our technology like most inventors do, so it was certainly a risk, but that risk certainly paid off big time.
What is a trademark? Did that same patent attorney assist you in trademarking the name of the product? If not, when did you handle your trademark issues?
The trademark really happens concurrent, and a lot of patent attorneys, again, I'm not one, will tell you that as long as your name is out there, it's trademarkable. If it's out there, and if I got like a sales receipt or certainly like a sales brochure, if the box that the Abdur is sold in, the Abdur is out there, and if I could prove the date, that will secure the trademark. But a trademark is really securing the sign or the indicator of that particular product. In my case, the Abdur, that name, is a trademark.
Now, you've got this product, you've got it patented, you've got a prototype, and you need money. What was your thinking at that point? You needed a private investor, you needed money to fund this project. How did you go about finding your angel investor? And explain to the listeners, what is an angel investor?
Well, I went about it just like anybody else would go about it. It's like, who do I know that's got money? And or who could I reach out to that would fund this project?
How much did you think you needed to get it going?
I can't remember if I had it figured out. I didn't go into it saying I need X amount of dollars. I went into it saying I need somebody to take over my costs of doing this process and you would enjoy a percentage of the profits. I went in with that. Some people say I need to raise $1 million, I need to raise $10 million, I need to raise $250,000. I didn't have an exact number in place, only because I didn't know. I mean, I had no idea. I had no way to do projections or any other stuff. I would have just pulled them out of the air, and I see a lot of inventors who come to me with projections. I go, where'd you get these numbers? I go, you just pulled them out of the air, right? You know, it's like, okay, I'm going to sell 1 million units. 1 million times $5 royalty is $5. Projections are just that. They're projections. They're not tangible figures. They're ideas. So I went to my financial advisor, my accountant, and when I went to the bank, I just started telling people, I have an invention, I'm looking for investors. I mean, I got the energy going, man. That's the power of networking. And one of my financial advisors who has set up my insurances and stuff, he obviously was financial advisor for other people, and he says, hey, I know a guy who knows you. He sees you on TV all the time because of my TV show. He'd love to meet you. So we set up a meeting. From day one, I mean, it was almost like that meeting, it was like the easiest thing for me. Now, granted, I went into there being a household celebrity. My TV show was airing all the time. So when John Abdul came walking into your house, it's like, hey, I've seen this guy before. He's got something good going for him.
Were you back in Chicago or in California?
No, I was in Chicago at the time. So I already had a credibility and name and image awareness already branded. I had brand equity to myself. So other inventors don't have that advantage, but that doesn't mean that they're at a disadvantage. I mean, there's ways around it. So he decided to invest, and he had resources, people who could help me with prototypes and accounting and all that other stuff. So, Michael, I wasn't just looking for money. If someone would have just thrown $1 million on the table and says, here, take the money and go and produce, now all of a sudden I would be in charge of having to spend that money and finding the people I would spend that money to. That's a huge, huge operation. I wanted to develop the product, and I wanted to be the spokesperson of the product, and I wanted to have an association of people who did what they were supposed to do. So my angel investor wasn't just an angel who just threw me money. He gave me resources and his expertise, and he was just a great, great guy.
He knew how to take it to market?
Basically, he helped other people develop businesses and or build businesses and sell businesses for profit. That was his forte and his claim to fame, and he's a very, very wealthy man. So we had a great relationship there. So when you're looking for something that you desire to find, You'll find it. I tell people, just get that energy going. Get the ball rolling, and you will find what you're looking for.
All right, what's realistic? I mean, you had to think, well, how much of my company do I have to give away? Was there negotiating back and forth? What was your thinking before you went in for that meeting? I'm sure you had some concerns or questions of how much this guy's going to want, and what advice would you give someone else who's looking for money, how much to give away or how much to keep for yourself?
Today, when I go into presentations, it's a whole lot different. I'm 12 years as an inventor, not just a guy who had an invention. I'm an inventor now. I operate under inventing business principles. So when I go into a presentation, I pretty much know if it's not pinpoint what the range of my high and low acceptance would be. Back then, especially having admiration with the gentleman that ultimately invested in me, I entrusted him in giving me a proposal because he knew startup businesses and what it would take and what would be fair and stuff like that. So I told him, I said, give me an offer that you feel is fair, but it's in both our best interests, but more importantly, it's in the best interest of the project because there's a lot of people involved with this. And he gave me a very, very fair offer.
So who was in control? Did you lose control because you had it?
No, in fact, when I say he gave me a very fair offer, he made sure, he says, John, you need to retain control and ownership of your property. I'll come in, I'll invest my money, I am going to get a percentage of the profits, but you own the intellectual property, you have all rights to the project. If we license it away to somebody else, they are licensee of that project as long as they're producing. And it was a very, very fair offer. I mean, I learned so much from this guy, and I hit a grand slam home run almost my first time up at bat with this guy because not only was he astute and very professional, but part of being astute and very professional was that he was honest and looking literally at the entire project, and he was making decisions as if it was his project, which is the only way to really look at a deal. It has to be win-win. You can't do a deal of a what's in it for me type of attitude, because even if he would have given me 99% of the business, which I'm not going to disclose what he gave me because that's confidential and each project has its own dynamics, but even if he gave me like super duper control of the business, ultimately it would have failed because it was lopsided. It would have been totally in my favor but in disfavor for other elements and other parties and associates and resources within that project. So it has to be for the project in totality. So I always tell people, never ever only think about me. Always think about we, because that's the only way a project is going to thrive.
Yeah, don't be greedy. The other party's going to be resentful.
You know, people, especially inventors, and I'm an inventor, and I know the personality traits, we go into these things very desperate, and we are easily manipulated, and we regret it later on. But the thing is, being desperate, it's like, oh, bankrupt, which I was. I'm losing my house. I'm losing my cars. I got to move. I got to liquidate everything I own. I lost my business, my TV show. I mean, everything was going. I needed money. First thing you would think of, take care of John here. Take care of John. But I knew the long term would not be the best picture if I only looked at John. I had to look at what's best for the project. John was part of the project, but being a part didn't mean that I was going to take everything up front, and it worked out the best.
So tell me you really were blessed. You got lucky with this guy, and you got an honest partner. Other people aren't so lucky. What about someone who goes to a venture capital? Are there warnings that other people who have great ideas, patented products, people that they should stay away from?
Well, first off, I really don't want to say that I was lucky, although luck certainly plays into it. I did have a lot of skill sets going into it with my marketing knowledge in the fitness business, particularly fitness television. I was producing a TV show. I produced 600 TV shows, commercials, instructional videotapes. I knew how to produce. I knew how to advertise on TV. I knew how to produce commercials. I knew how to market and syndicate. So I went into there with several skill sets, but now I was starting a whole new business, albeit a different type of business, and I entrusted that decision to somebody else. If he would have given me an offer, I said, hey, even though this guy's giving me money, I don't like the offer, I would have walked away from the deal, even if he would have given me a lot of money, because I wasn't only looking for money. So I did have a certain degree of expectation, which was filled beyond my expectations, which is a real great deal. Now, when you talk about other investors and venture capitalists and things like that, obviously each proposal or project has its own dynamics. But as I mentioned, I consult a lot of inventors. And inventors come to me and go, John, I got this great contract. It's unbelievable. I got this great attorney. He read it. He wants me to sign it. Would you mind reading it, John, and just giving me your input on this? Okay, this guy told me he's got a great proposal from a great company who does great things. His patent attorney, who's obviously on his side, is a great patent attorney and has approved this so-called great contract. I read this contract, and knowing what I know now on how loopholes are created and how you could blow holes in these contracts, I read this contract and I go, there's no way in this or any other lifetime I would ever sign that contract. So there are things that people need to know, even great attorneys, if they don't specifically know infomercial businesses and or direct response businesses or internet businesses or paying royalties and things like that, you know, cost of goods. If they don't know all the different schematics, it could look like a good deal. But I'm telling you, when it comes time to sit down in court, even though you know what you were expecting and what you were verbally promised, there's ways that that contract would fall in disfavor to yourself.
Okay. You've got your big idea. You've got it patented and protected. You've got an angel investor, so you've got money. You've got your prototype. How did you know that your product was a product that would do well on television, and did you consider or make any efforts to sell the product in any other distribution channels first to prove saleability?
Back then, there wasn't any other distribution channels other than retail. Internet was just starting out at the time, so that was not a consideration. In retail, if you remember, back in 1997 and 2, 3, 4, 5 years after that, when you seen a product on TV, it would say, only available on TV. This is the only place you can order this product. Call this number now, not available in stores. So TV was the only route. I mean, I truly knew that this product would be successful once I got it in front of anybody, because the Abdur, which works the spinal column, everybody owns a spinal column. So I knew it was going to be of benefit to anybody and everybody, even people in wheelchairs and handicapped people. I tested it on that crowd. I tested it on professional athletes. I tested it on obese people. I use it myself. I mean, there's so many applications to this product. I knew it was something somebody need. Plus, the Abs is the number one selling fitness product ever on TV, so the abdominal region was one of the main focuses, although it was the entire middle region, which I told people, hey, why just think about the abs when you can think about the whole waistline? All of a sudden, a light bulb went in their head. They go, oh my gosh, I've never trained my lower back, and I'm not really training my obliques. Here's a machine that does that. So, you know, Michael, I knew I had something good based on my Olympic experience with myself being an Olympic athlete, coaching Olympic athletes, being a fitness consultant, working in rehabilitation, co-joined with orthopedic surgeons and physical therapists. It had a healthy benefit to it, and it had the cosmetic or look-good benefit at the same time.
All right, tell me the story about when you were able to present your idea to the marketing company. How did that originate? And this is the one that succeeded. Were there any prior companies that you had proposals with that almost went through or that you were about to go with? Or was this the first one you met that took it on that created the whole success?
Well, all the companies that I presented it to, I kind of like met everybody at a trade show, which trade shows are really great.
Were you an exhibitor?
I wasn't an exhibitor. I was just walking around, shaking hands, and some people recognized me from my TV show, other people, you know, who are you type of thing. I'm John Abdul, I'm an Olympic coach, I invented a product, and I'd like to see if your company would be interested in having an in-person disclosure. I did not disclose the product at the convention. I considered it intellectual property, and I wanted to give the product its due respect in giving a formal disclosure in a concentrated presentation, not at a trade show where there's hundreds of people tugging everybody at the sleeves. So I had like 4 or 5 companies that were interested, and I set up one with one company. I actually set up meetings with all the companies, but the first company that I had a meeting with, they had just done several big, gigantic infomercial projects. I mean, $150 million in gross revenues. One was $170 million in gross revenues. And what I found out is that they were just a production company for this, but they were dying for an idea that they would get themselves involved in that they would own. So when I met with them, my angel investor and myself, we flew out to meet with them. We sat down. We were doing our dog and pony. At that time, we produced a nice little demo video, which we played on their TV monitor. I had the prototype there. We had some drafts of some brochures and our trademarks and stuff, and I gave my presentation. I'm John Abdul, the inventor, and I'm also the spokesperson. I showed them my abs. I'm in good shape. I told them my story. I was fat and out of shape. Now I'm in shape. I had a bad back. Now I have a good back. Gave them the whole story, and at the end of that meeting, we all shook hands. knowing that we were going to work together within 2 weeks. Well, actually, within 2 days, we had a letter of earnest that they didn't want us to show it to anybody as they were going to draft a formal contract for us, and we were in business. So it was really a wonderful scenario, and it was very securing because now I knew I had a marketing partner, and as I mentioned before, they were assuming other parts of the risk factors within this project, which I didn't have to assume. They were specifically producers and marketers, and I was the inventor, the program developer, and the on-air spokesperson, so I was going to be pretty busy, which I was. I was on live TV all over the world. I was traveling constantly. I made live appearances at trade shows and live TV events. I was doing guest speaking engagements to promote my technology as an inventor and specifically for the Abdur. Ultimately, it became the number one product in the world. It was fantastic. I was the number one inventor of the world, number one spokesperson. The infomercial was the number one infomercial in the world. I mean, it won all the awards.
All right, let me ask you this. Were you out in California by this time?
No. I was still living in Chicago when I made that presentation to them, but I was still running low on finances. I still had to liquidate everything. It was going to be a while before this thing was going to be sold. It was going to be months and months and months. So I moved out to California and got myself set up. And like I said, I had 6 months to the day to start earning royalty checks. And sure enough, like clockwork, I mean, if you're looking at a stopwatch, when 6 months hit, boom, I got my first royalty check.
All right, so you consummated the deal in Chicago, and you moved out to California because you knew this thing was going to go forward, and you were just getting ready for it.
Correct.
Okay, so that's smart. You went to a trade show, and you were looking for expertise in the marketing area. This type of company, what specifically was their expertise, and what would you recommend an inventor who's got a patented product who wants to market it via TV to look for in a company?
Well, you know, that's kind of a loaded question, and the reason why I say that is because there's some companies that only do one thing. They'll produce the infomercial, but they're not the manufacturer, they're not the distributor, they're not the marketer, they're not the media buyer, they're not the telemarketing company, they're not the customer service, they're not the warehouse or fulfillment company. There's a lot that goes on. Some companies say that they do all that, and either they're blatantly not telling you the truth, or they have the resources and they outsource all that. And that could be indicated in the contract where ABC marketing firm and its associates will have worldwide exclusive rights to all aspects of this operation type of thing. So these are things that the inventor has to be aware of.
So did this company have the expertise to handle all of this for you?
No. The company I licensed it to, unfortunately, they spelled themselves out to be an A to Z company, and they weren't. They wanted to be because they had produced big, big projects in the past, but they were part of the project, but not the whole of the project. So they actually kind of like oversold themselves to me, which was kind of disappointing, and that's one of the reasons why I went near bankrupt and I had to sell my house, because it took a lot longer for us to bring it into the marketplace. But the great thing that happened from that is that they did produce a great infomercial, and we did have several elements in place, but would have been bringing the project out in 1 year, which we did test in 1 year. Things didn't work out that well in 1997. It wasn't until late part of 1999, 2000, which I had to repackage the project and still involve these guys, but had to license other aspects of the project to other companies. That's when the project became the big hit and winner. So a lot of people wonder what happened between 1997 and 2000. That was a very tough period for me because I had thought, hey, I have everything I need to get this project going. I had a piece of it, and the guys that I said I licensed this technology to, they're great guys, but they did overextend themselves. They got themselves involved in some areas that they were not completely qualified to do. They knew the people involved in those processes, but they were trying to assume roles that they never assumed before. And most of the time, when you do something new, Michael, you know, you got to learn.
No, absolutely. This is critical because you're going through a lot of challenges that other inventors will go through. And it's important that they know that it's not all going to be smooth sailing. There's going to be challenges, but we want the listeners to know what they can learn from the challenges that you experienced. Now, when you did set up a licensing agreement with this company, were you stuck with them because of the agreement for a certain amount of time where your hands were tied?
Yeah. Absolutely.
For how long?
Well, it wasn't so much how long. It's just like, okay, we got all this energy going in this direction. Now, how do we come to a screeching halt and completely change in the other direction? So it was time, it was energy. It was like, man, I talked to this company a year ago. Remember the trade show I told you I went to?
Right.
I blew all these other people off because the first party I met with the party who shook my hand, we ultimately had to deal with. Now for me to come crawling back with my tail between my legs to these other companies and say, hey, guys, guess what? Yeah, I licensed it to another company, but they're not doing everything I wanted them to do. You guys work with me now. You know, professionally, it's not the best thing to do. So it took me a while to restructure my business. And as a consultant right now, I learned so much about negotiating contracts and holding people accountable. For instance, if someone says, yeah, I'm an infomercial marketing company, and all of a sudden the inventor thinks I'm going to do everything for them, that inventor better be prepared to ask me the questions. And this is what I negotiate with my contracts and when I represent other companies and other inventors. Are you the manufacturer? Are you the media buyer? Are you the warehouse? Are you the telemarketing company? Are you the fulfillment company? Because all these other resources, and there's many more than I just mentioned, are costs of doing business. So when you have, say, for instance, a royalty that's based on net profit as opposed to gross profit, that difference between net and gross, factor in all these other agencies. Now, if everything's under one roof, which they very rarely are, and I learned the hard way, then they're being outsourced at top dollar. So let's say, for instance, you generate $1 million in gross revenue. According to their accounting, there may be $200,000 in net revenue. And when they split up everything, you're left with $20 in your pocket. And you go, hey, you know, we just made $1 million. How do I end up with 20 bucks? But that's part of the negotiation that specifically isolates where are the dollars being allocated, who's part of this project, who's being outsourced, who's insourced, what are the costs of operations, what is the definition of gross versus net revenues, you know, how does the accounting finally shake out? And most inventors don't believe it, but they only get like 1, maybe 2% inventor's royalty, which could be significant if you sell a lot of product. But what does 1% really mean? What does that mean in dollars and cents? Because today, you never hear an inventor saying, well, I get $1 a unit or $5 a unit or $10 a unit. They'll always give you a percentage because the price historically of a product will change. You know, it'll start high and come down. So if they're selling a product at $200 originally, but 6 months later, they go, hey, you know, we got to mark this thing down. Now they're selling it for $100, if they're giving you $5 a unit at $200, they can't give you $5 a unit at $1. So a percentage would be a sliding scale based on the ups and downs of the pricing structure. And when a product goes to retail, that's a wholesale price, not a retail price. So the wholesale buyer buys that $200 product at, say, like $135. So you don't get paid on the $200 that the customer would pay for that product. You would get paid on the $135 that the retailer would pay for that product.
So what standard royalty in the industry for an inventor to get when he licenses his product, a percentage of gross or a percentage of net?
Well, it'd be nice if you got a percentage of gross, but I doubt if that'll happen. And there's always exceptions to the rules. And even though I have been specific in the fitness industry, I've been consulting inventors. You know, one guy had a construction project, another one had cooking appliances, automotive, things like that. So each industry is going to structure their royalties and pricing structure different. So each one has its own dynamic. And I usually like to address those, Mike, not in a broad or general term, but on an exact project-by-project basis. So that's the scenario. And what I do and what's been to my benefit and how I make my money, first and foremost, is that I always try to secure myself with manufacturing, because I know the manufacturers now, and the manufacturers say, hey, John, if it's going to cost us $18 to produce this product, you sell it to somebody else for $20, we'll give you $2. So I get paid once the products are being manufactured. I get paid even before the products are even sold, and I'm very transparent. I let everyone know about this. And in addition to me being the manufacturer's rep, which is a source that these companies don't have to do, so me getting paid that $2 per unit is something they would pay to somebody else anyway. And being the inventor, I get an inventor's royalty. Being spokesperson, I get paid a spokesperson fee. So I've learned to negotiate all the roles that I'm participating in the project and what's fair for me to get out of it. When I represent inventors, that's what I try to get. What are you contributing? And here's what you're worth, and here's what we're going to ask for, and here's what you're entitled to. So if you're just an inventor, obviously you're going to get one thing, but if you're contributing more, and as I mentioned earlier, if you come in with patents and prototypes and things like that, your inventor's royalty is worth more money because you've lowered their risk.
The first company, it didn't work out. They kind of overstated what they could do, and your hands were tied. The success didn't really result with them. Was this until you found another company?
The success as far as selling the units for revenue profit wasn't successful. But as far as developing the infomercial and getting the project to another level, which my investor and myself were not capable of doing, that was...
So you stayed with them in the infomercial development part of it.
Yeah, well, they produced the infomercial, but they signed manufacturing to a group that was charging them double what the cost of goods were. They had no clue of what the manufacturing cost of goods should be. They were getting raped, excuse the expression, on the cost of goods. So even though we had high call volume, we were not selling the products at the profit that we wanted. So that part of it failed. But later on, I became aware of other manufacturers. And as I mentioned earlier, there was 33, maybe more, knockoffs of the Abdur. So there were factories all over Asia, probably all over the world, that were producing the Abdur. These factories, they're telling their reps that go out around the world to trade shows, surfing the internet, looking in stores, what's selling out there? We got to copy that thing. They're in business to sell product. Manufacturers are coming to me saying, John, if you ever got another product, let us manufacture it for you. We'll deal directly with you. We are the manufacturer. You pay no middleman, and if you want, we'll cut you in on the manufacturing. And I found out that that was the best way to go. So now I have direct contact with the manufacturers. I don't need to go through any buffer or middle agency or middleman.
All right, that's smart. So you had to renegotiate your agreement with this company.
Yeah.
They were okay with that?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I still do business with them today. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, it's kind of funny, and I'll use this analogy, and hopefully it comes out right. It's like when you marry somebody, you think you know them, but after a while, it's like, hey, they're squeezing the toothpaste tube the wrong way, but that wasn't until after you got married. And I'm the kind of guy, I say, hey, even though we have a contract and the attorney will say you have to follow everything within the confines of that legal agreement, hey, there are things within a relationship, a growing relationship, that are always being changed, modified, enhanced, and things like that. So I'm the kind of guy, I want to roll up the sleeves and say, Mr. So-and-so or Mr. Partner or Mr. Investor, things are changing or things have changed or I envision something changing. What is the best way to handle this for both of our interests? I've never been one to point fingers in somebody's face or blame anybody. It's like we're all trying to do the best we can do, and new projects require new dynamics with new decisions, and every once in a while you hit your head up against the wall and you just try to diplomatically try to ease the situation the best you can.
You communicated. You worked it out.
I always try to work it out. That's the way I live my life. I try to work things out. What's fair? Now, if the group is doing something illegal or unethical, then I will point my finger at their face, and I'll be very confrontational and let them know this is wrong, it's illegal, it's unethical, it's not fair, it is way beyond the boundaries of our legal obligation to one another. And even if it's not written in a contract, as I mentioned earlier, there's some contracts that people believe are great contracts, but people do things outside the boundaries of the contract, which according to law may not be illegal, but it's a pain in the gluteus maximus, man. I mean, it's like, how could you people act like that or do those types of things? And I've learned over the years, and that's what makes me better at what I do and great at consulting other people on what to do.
All right, very good advice. So keep control of the manufacturing. Let's talk a little bit about manufacturing. Were there plenty of people who could manufacture a good quality product, and were you concerned about quality with it being made in China, and how did you control that?
There's a lot of quality manufacturers out there, and they're always popping up. I mean, you could bring them anything. You can go to a department store right now and buy a blender or a shoehorn or a coffee cup or a cell phone or whatever it is and go to a factory and say, duplicate this, and they will duplicate it, Michael. I mean, that's how good these guys are at manufacturing things. So as far as the manufacturing process is concerned, you're not short of manufacturing, but even though it looks like the product that you want to have, does it function and it's going to hold up? So manufacturing quality is a key, and that's another cost of doing business, because I go to the factories. I'm there with the white gloves, so to say, wiping the assembly line, seeing the materials, and making sure that the quality of the product is not being jeopardized and it's being manufactured in a way to where the customer has what we promise, a strong, durable, functional item.
So you had a good relationship with your original manufacturer, and you're still with them?
No, I didn't have a good relationship with them. The thing is, when you sell as many items as I sell, you need multiple factories and multiple manufacturers. So even though I had a good relationship with that factory, I have other factories doing different things for me.
I see. Did you work directly with the manufacturers, or are there agencies that can help an American buffer and work with these manufacturers?
Yes to both questions. For my products, I work directly with them. However, I do have a new product that I'm working on right now. It's a real exciting fitness product, and I know this product is going to sell extremely well in the marketplace. actually a manufacturing agent who's also a great engineer, which is very important because they could take my rough idea and really put bells and whistles to the design and function and packaging of the product. They came to me and they said, hey, John, you got another product. Let us work with you on it. And I'm happy to work with them and let them get paid because that's just an extra energy of doing business that I don't have to do. And I love and enjoy delegating responsibility because I'm busy enough. When the project is big, the pie can be sliced up so many different ways. It also incentivizes other people to do a great job for you. So instead of me always going to the factory, which is a very cumbersome, uncomfortable trip sometimes, obviously, I'll let somebody else handle that for me. In a lot of other circumstances, I'm dealing directly with the factories myself.
Tell me when you knew this thing really hit big and what it was like. And when the infomercial was produced, do you remember the very first time it ran? Was it running as a test? Tell me what led up to where you knew you had a huge winner.
Well, you know, at the beginning, even though the first phase of the project was not favorable, and as I mentioned, because of the manufacturing and things like that, the project was a success right from the very beginning. It was voted the number one product in 1997 at the Sporting Good Manufacturers Association show. It was the big sporting goods show. It's a worldwide expo, which I had the product on display there. 120,000 products. I mean, this place was gigantic at the World Congress Center in Atlanta, and John Abdo, his invention, and myself were voted the number one product at that convention. So I knew the product was going to be an instant success. My first royalty check was $3,400. The second one was $8,400. The third one was $34,000. The fourth one was $84,000, and that was per month. It grew up to $125,000 per week. I mean, it was just incredible. So being $100,000 in debt, I put a goal in my mind. I need to get that $100,000 back. And I was earning well over $100,000 per week, which is $500,000 per month. And it was just obviously a blessing, not only for myself, but knowing how many other people were benefiting from this project. The 4,000 people at the factory, the raw material suppliers, the delivery truck drivers, the retail store clerks, the media buyers, the telemarketers, the fulfillment companies. It was just one of those things, well, wow, my idea has had such a huge global impact. It really defined that it's not about me, it's about we slogan that I live by. And it just gave me so much more pleasure in seeing the big picture and the big impact in other people's lives, which obviously made me very proud.
So who was operating the company? Were you the main focus of it, or was your partner handling all these details?
There's a way where you could say I was spearheading the whole project because I'd handle any part of the A to Z operation. But, you know, I was wise enough to have delegates and associates that specified in specific areas because I don't want to have to do certain aspects of the operation, but I do a lot of aspects of the operation. I do a lot of customer service. Believe it or not, I call people up who've purchased the product. Some people may have great things to say about it. Some people don't even know I'm calling. Some people may have some concerns. I call people up, hi, this is John Abdo, the inventor of the Abdur. I mean, all of a sudden you hear the phone bouncing off the floor. They go, I can't believe you're calling me. And I tell people, I'm not your typical infomercial guy. I'm a real fitness professional who used to coach people in the gym. Now I'm selling a product on TV. I never get a chance to meet people like yourself. And I just want to call and say hello and thank you for investing in my technology. And I want you to know that the real relationship starts now, which I say that more confidently now in the last 2 or 3 years because my websites, which are specific for each project, johnabdo.com, abdur.com, buttonthighdur.com, are specifically intended to educate and motivate people, not just on the specific product that they buy from me, but on the whole lifestyle. And I got audio seminars, I got video seminars on the websites, I do frequently asked questions, testimonials, and again, it spans all areas of spiritual, intellectual, emotional, physical health that are in and surrounding the whole lifestyle needs of that particular person. And it's my way of staying connected to my patronage, my students, my customers, and something I really enjoy. I'm not a typical infomercial guy, Michael. I just happen to be an Olympic coach, an Olympic athlete who invented a product. All of a sudden I'm on TV, becomes the number one product in the world, and it's not the most social business in the world. When you're on TV as much as I'm on TV, I'm sitting at home watching myself on TV, and I'm sitting here by myself, and millions of people are watching me. So I had to think, how do I get myself back involved with exchanging energy with these people? So I do a lot of consulting, do a lot of live seminars, but my website and my phone consultations have been really remarkable in reconnecting me with the population out there.
Great. John, when you went with that first company, you had told me that their expertise was in developing an effective infomercial. From what you know about the infomercial industry and the infomercials we see on TV, how many of these things actually make money?
Not many. You know, it's a very high-risk venture, and a lot of companies out there and a lot of individuals. I'm approached by a lot of people, inventors and marketing people, product owners, project owners, that tug me at the sleeves and say, John, can you help me get a product on an infomercial? And they don't understand the complexities of it, number one, and they don't understand the cost of it, as well as the failure rate. The failure rate is extremely high. So when you have a winner, you know, I mean, you're walking around chest high, chin high, and just really proud that you've been able to accomplish something like that. I'm in that bunch, but I've also been part of projects that haven't succeeded, and all the elements were there, Michael. I mean, we just don't know what works until you really put it on the air and test it. But I've heard something like 97% of all infomercials fail, which is a huge, huge percentage. So, again, it's not a sure bet. It's like putting your coin in a slot machine and pulling that one-arm jack. You're really chancing, and I've seen infomercials that some people say, well, hey, I'm going to go to XYZ Corporation. I'm just giving that as a name, that produces infomercials for $1 million. They say, hey, if I put $1 million in the infomercial, for sure it's going to sell. I seen a scenario one time where this company produced an infomercial, and it was a $200,000-$300,000 production, a nice production, and the show was bombing on TV. It just wasn't doing well at all. But the company still had funds, and they went to another production company, reshot the whole show for $1 million, and the results were actually worse with the $1 million show as opposed to the $200,000-$300,000 show. There's no set answer. A lot of it is skill, but the other 3% of it is luck. It's the timing. When you bring a product into the marketplace, you never know who is working on a project concurrent with yours, that when you start testing it, you go, oh my gosh, here's another ad product where I thought that mine was going to be the only one on TV, and all of a sudden there's not just one, but there's two other ad products on TV. So you have competition, the viewer has a choice to make, and today's viewers are so educated that they will go back and forth and back and forth, and they'll call all the numbers, they'll ask for the best deals, they'll take notes, they'll go to the internet and search on there to see if they can find the best deal. They're really an educated buyer these days. So it's not just the infomercial that works. It's all other channels of distribution, from telemarketing to website sales and things like that, that really back you up, because if you don't make it on TV, you better make it up somewhere else.
How long can it take to produce a full infomercial? How long did your production company take to finish it from start to finish in a matter of months?
Well, every project I've been involved with, everyone says, hey, we got to get this thing up and going really quick. And sure, when something is high risk, it's like, let's get it out there as fast as we can so we can start getting our return on investment ASAP. But I'm the kind of guy, I like to have a project mature on its own. Of course, I'm very persistent, I'm very aggressive, and I don't sleep well during a project or sleep as much because I'm working on the project 24/7. But it takes a long time.
Should you do the golden rule? If they tell you it's going to take 6 months, just plan on a year?
No, not really, because sometimes 6 months could turn into 3 months. It all depends on how things materialize, and it depends on the kind of product.
Let's talk about your Abdur.
But with exercise equipment, now you need a user group. You need to prove that this thing works with any type of nutritional product or exercise product. So now you need a user group. User group is going to take at least 2 months. Actually, more than that, when you have to design the routines and train the instructors to teach these classes or put somebody in the user group, do before and after pictures, measurements, and then do some kind of a clinical study. So that takes several months in and of itself. But concurrent to that, you're working on the product, you're working on manufacturing, you're working on distribution, you're securing a lot of things, pre-production, planning. So there's a lot of stuff going on simultaneously. And that's why I formed NICA, the National Inventors Coaching Alliance, because when people see me on TV, they may say that, hey, John did it by himself. I can assure you that even though I may have invented the product by myself, I certainly didn't bring it into the marketplace by myself. There's an alliance of people that are surrounding every project, and these are things that people need to consider when they bring it into the marketplace. They also need to consider that when another company has to take on the risk of a project, that they have to put in manpower, time, energy and money. And as you mentioned, yeah, 6 months could be a year, and some people could expedite it a lot quicker. I am much more efficient these days than 10, 12 years ago in taking a concept and bringing it into the marketplace, because I have the alliance and I have the know-how, but still it takes time for it to mature.
You're listening to an exclusive interview on hardtofindseminars.com with John Abdo. This is the end of part 2. Please continue to part 3.